Let me wish you all a serene and a happy new year and new decade. In this coming decade may prove the decade of realization for some. For others, it may be the decade of striving to be followed by realization. I think these decades will prove fundamentally important in ushering in the new world age, which has already dawned. The old cycle, which started somewhere around 2,000 years before the birth of Christ, is now really quite over, although most people are unaware of that. That which characterized that immense arc of time must give place to the new. Particularly the hierarchical conception of life. Of what we commonly call the spiritual world. And in the affairs of men, in human societies. That hierarchical conception has had its day and it is out. It served its purpose, but its day is over. Also, associated with that hierarchical conception, authority and the acceptance of authority and the deriving of truth on the basis of authority, all that is over. Also, the relationships between man and man are already different from what they were almost till the end of the last century. And a new sort of relationship between man and man is trying to emerge. And finally, amongst the main characteristics of the new age, the urgency of the need for discovering truth for oneself. Truth in every sense, whether it be scientific and mathematical, or whether it be psychological, or whether it be spiritual. To discover that for oneself and to verify it and find its matter of fact, literal expression in our daily life, will be one of the keynotes of the new age. All these factors are different from that which went before. But unfortunately, as in so much of the history of the world, changes take place cataclysmically, hurtfully, destructively. There are always some, however, who have vision, who have understanding. Some who are free of the curse of orienting everything to oneself. free of selfness, and they make the truest and the greatest contribution to the ushering in of a new age. We are concerned with religion, not just with the different garbs of religion, named Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism or anything else, but with the reality of religion, that essential reality, which is a reality of our own inmost being, and not just of any external system that we follow, or faith that we profess. Now, there are very deep implications to all this. As long as the hierarchical system prevailed, whether it be politically, spiritually, socially, or in any other way, the freedom of the individual was inevitably restricted. It wasn't a true freedom. To this day, how many men are there who know what freedom really means? That supreme transcendental freedom, which is just that one is what one is, and remains as such, although undergoing change, although going through immense activity, that transcendental freedom is unknown to people. If I say it in so many words as I have just used, the meaning of those words is immediately constricted into the little mold of people's conception of freedom. But to be free is utterly different from having a conception of freedom and attempting to conform to the conception. Then the reality gets lost. As long as the hierarchical system prevailed, authority necessarily prevailed. And all this restricted human freedom. And in the restriction of human freedom, human beings never are able to be fully, wholly human. The holy ones through the ages, they were not so very many, but they were a fair number. The holy ones through the ages realized freedom. In their realization of freedom, they extricated themselves out of the net which held them in, the net of authority, of hierarchy. What one realizes, that is to say, makes real for oneself, not merely by intellectual imposition or by being subject to one's illusions, but what one makes real for oneself is one's actual spiritual freedom, one's real inner status, so to say. Man is a religious being, essentially. That secondarily, he's a political, social, economic animal. This is perfectly true. When Aristotle said man's a political animal, he used the right word, animal. when Rousseau said man is a social animal. Animal is the right word. And again, Marx, Lenin, economic animal. That is perfectly true. The animal part is all this. Restricted and restrictive. But in his inmost core, man is a religious being. And the religious being is a free being. For to be religious means to be utterly free of the bondage of selfness. Not to be merely unselfish as a conflicting opposite to selfishness. Not that. But to be really unself, whilst confined within the organic physical limits of a distinctive self. This is man's task. Not merely to believe that the infinite is embodied in the finite appearance which is this, that or the other person. Not merely to believe that, but actually to realize it in consciousness. And if there is the realization in consciousness, then all that emanates from the finite being as a political, social, economic animal will be pure, it'll be whole, it'll be holy. Which means it'll be completely and totally related to all other beings and to the total environment. And this is the new kind of relationship which, it seems to me, the coming millennia will embody. The relationships between man and man in this great 4,000-year cycle which is over have been relationships of bondage, of restriction. And when I say bondage and restriction, I mean they have been based upon the principle of reciprocity. All that we have achieved, in the finest sense, if you like, in human relationships, taking societies as a whole, that is, in the mass, has been based upon the principle of reciprocity. But the new principle, or rather, the principle which will now begin to show itself more and more in actual manifestation, is absoluteness, which means transcendent love. Not a reciprocal love. We promise to love, honor, and cooperate with or obey each other or whatever it is. Not that. No, nothing conditional. It is the unconditional. And the unconditional becomes a possibility only to the unselfed consciousness. As long as there is the separate self-consciousness, it is technically, practically impossible to express an absolute ethic in life. So this is perhaps something of the new spirit of the coming cycle. Cycle which dawned quite a while ago. You might ask, why do I particularly mention it in connection with this coming decade and the next decade? It's just a hunch, if you like. But it seems to me as if climax will come towards the latter part of the 1980s. Will that climax come in terms of cataclysm? Or not? Will it come partly in terms of cataclysm, partly in terms of creative renewal? Or can it come wholly in terms of creative renewal? You know the great Indian epic, the Mahabharata. You know the corresponding Greek epic, the Iliad. These epics represent the crashing of the old world order in terms of cataclysm. The good and the bad are equally killed off, destroyed. There's widespread ruin. In a small way, I say small because it was confined to Western Europe, we saw that with the disruption of the Roman Empire. And then it was the extraordinary will and determination and skill of some of the great Christians who are known as saints, people like Saint Benedict. Gregory the Great, and one or two others like that, who saved Western culture by imposing powerful restrictions upon the lives of the people. On the one hand, where society was concerned, and by founding the monastic orders, on the other hand, to preserve by a strict disciplinary life, by means of a strict disciplinary life, that which they saw, understood, and realized for themselves as the finest in their Judeo-Christian tradition. Cassiodorus, Saint Benedict, and Gregory the Great. I think those were three amongst the very important people, round about the 5th century AD. Rome fell in 455, wasn't it? About 455 AD, that Rome was finally completely overcome by the Huns and under Alaric and so forth. Well, that was on a small scale. The Mahabharata represents it on the very big scale. No one knows the period of the Mahabharata, but something happened apparently. And similarly, Homer represents it in the Iliad, in connection with Troy. Now, will it happen that way? It could. Or will it happen, as in the case of the Roman Empire, that whilst on the one hand there seemed to be a large destruction, on the other hand there was the effort and work which did fructify of a small handful of people with some vision at least happening together? Or could it happen without the repetition of this incredible stupidity, this senseless destructive stupidity which has marked human history for as long as we can remember history? Now, putting it this way, I am putting it in old world terms. That is to say, I am putting it in terms where we consider forms. But this is one of the things that will be out with the New Age. The preconceiving of the shape of things, the preconceiving of the nature of the way life will flow in the future. Now, this is a mistake. You will notice, I mentioned Rome, and I mentioned Benedict, Cassiodorus, and others, particularly for this reason. They preconceived. They had what they call their faith, which certainly was faith partly in the real sense, as we considered the last time we met here, was real faith, empty of beliefs, this mysterious, wonderful, vital, living thing within. But it was also very considerably a question of set beliefs, a picture of the future, to be imposed by those who served the Lord, or those who are concerned with the well-being and happiness of humanity. Now that age is right out. It is dead in fact. But for, it is more than likely that for centuries, millions of people will still continue to function in the old way. In a curious way, a corpse isn't dead. Human life does go on in a corpse-like way for quite a bit of time into the new age. You can't avoid this. It takes all sorts to make a world, as we say. But if we are seriously concerned with religion, the question will arise, what can we do? If we have any sort of sense, a sensitivity of the emergence of this new world. Now, let us approach it this way. In the very first place, what can we do is the wrong question. Because there can be no doing without the thinking and the feeling. The moment you have thought, you have constricted your feeling. You have put it into a shape. You have predetermined. But who am I to predetermine the shape of the future for life? Only in my ignorance, my folly, do I try to preconceive shapes. Only because I have the arrogant conceit that I know or can know what belongs to the transcendent, only to God. I can't know. No one ever really knew. Even when a Jesus or a Buddha predicted one or two things about the future, the shape of it, it was all wrong. It just didn't happen that way. This is a terrible lesson. But we must learn it. We must be wise. Recall what I said last time. Faithful equals belief empty. Let me change the question then. Not so much what can I do, but what can I be? And if we can see that question and approach it rightly, in a sense, and in a very profound sense, the other question, what can I do, is also answered. What can I be? In a single sentence, I can be unobstructive to the transcendent. The impossible task, is it not? And yet, if at least I know the nature of that thing, the transcendent is already using this in its own magical, mysterious way to transform this and help it to become so transformed that it could perhaps be unobstructive to the transcendent. This old so-called positive approach to life and everything is the egoistic approach, the self-centered approach, the approach which wants the perpetuation of the particular manifested separate being, separate self. But this is not the fullness of being. There is no supreme realization in the religious sense possible here. This is playing about forever and ever in the realm of conflicting dualities or multiplicity. if I was as clever as the devil and wise as God, and made a picture of how the universe ought to go, we shall be bound within the circle of mortality in everlasting conflict. Because the self is involved there. And the whole universe will be oriented to this self at its center. This is the great problem. To free oneself, to get free of this self-orientedness, this tremendously powerful self-consciousness, the limited self-consciousness. So, how shall I be unobstructive to the transcendent? Now ask the question, if you like, what do I do to be unobstructive? Now we shall see sense. Whatsoever I, as the particular I, do, is always obstructive to the transcendent. Therefore, I stop doing. That means I become quiet. Quiet. Supposing I can stop thinking, feeling, speaking, doing with the body. That is, doing with mind and body. Supposing I can stop it. What happens then? Nothing emanates out of this self, out and goes out to affect my environment. Whatsoever influences come in from the environment are never contended with by me. I am quiet. I am unobstructive. If light or heat or anything, or somebody says something, or the news, or anything whatsoever, if I am completely quiet in my mind and my body, this offers no obstruction to it. It is not in conflict with it. Now this actually happens to us every day in deep slumber. Unconsciously, in the state of the real deep slumber, we remain in a state of perfection. Not in conflict with the world, for the time being. But that perfection in deep slumber is the unawakened perfection. The whole purpose of human evolution and development is that that perfection shall be the awakened perfection. It will be the infinite consciousness which is totally free of the bonds, the limitations of self-consciousness, limited self-consciousness. And in that consciousness, in that sort of awareness, there is no conflict between what we commonly denominate self and not-self, the dividing line between self and not-self, between thou and I, God and man, is out. When that happens, all the thinking, feeling, speaking, doing, which takes place through this particular self, will necessarily be of the right shape. Unpredictable, unpicturable, unimaginable by me now as I am. You see the importance of trying to be free from the pictures, the imaginations. And thus, I am unobstructive to the transcendent. Now you see how? Thus, no doing in the, doing in the sense of the perfect doing, far from being excluded, is liberated into its actual true being of doing the perfect thing. Do you get it? See, religion is a matter of awareness. The context of religion at its heart, in its reality, in its living creative reality, is the transcendent. And the transcendent is not born, it doesn't age, it doesn't die, it is not limited, it is not sorrowful, it is not stained. It is pure. But we don't know the meaning of that purity, of that unsorrowing state. We don't know it. For us, the unsorrowing state is the opposite of our feeling miserable. But this dukkha, this sorrow of the universe, the Weltschmerz, am I using the correct German word? This Weltschmerz is something on a universal scale of which my little sorrow, howsoever tremendous to me or to any human being, is but a speck of dust only of this Weltschmerz. The travail of the universe, the transcendent knows. And because the transcendent loves, and because the transcendent is wise, it can absorb it all into itself. Can you and I become like that? But this precisely is our task. If our concern with religion is real and true, and not just another little titillation of our ordinary life in the world. We have ample evidence of these titillations. Look at the numberless societies that exist, which are concerned with meditation, with matters transcendent, with religion, with the deep things of life. All sorts of ologies and nosophies and goodness knows what. They all flourish in the worldly sense. Look at the sums of money involved in them all. The moment you see that happen, be careful. You can see the devil walking amongst them, having not only tea or dinner with them, but lunch and breakfast also. Watch carefully. Self-oriented, worldly. The world constricted, not the world transformed. This is the point. With the world constricted, there is accumulation, there is a burden, there is illness, therefore. This is. But with the world transformed, there is no thing. all things as we experience them with our physical senses are realized in terms of no thing. And because they are realized in terms of no thing, there is no bondage, there is no conflict in our inner consciousness. In our inner consciousness, remember, something immensely profounder than just intellect, thought, mind, use what words you like. So you see, to be unobstructive to the transcendent, naturally, when we converse, when we hear somebody or read something, the intellect, of course, is at play. If the intellect is not at play, well, you are just totally unaware of what's said or read or whatever it is. See? So shapes are formed in the mind. There is that other aspect of the activity of the mind, other very important aspect. Feels the truth, formlessly, shapelessly. Just as in deep slumber, you are unconsciously, and therefore without making forms and shapes, in harmony with the total environment. Similarly, when the feeling aspect, the touch sense, so to say, of the mind is at play, of the intellect itself is at play, the touch sense, then you are formlessly and shapelessly in relation with the truth, with reality. This is something that no ordinary logical-minded person could possibly swallow. And of course, quite naturally so. He might feel, and again, not unjustifiable because he is what he is, he might feel that we are talking nonsense. But it must be realized that talking nonsense is completely within the sphere of illogicality. But the truth is illogical, in which the conflict of logic and illogic is resolved into something which is beyond logic without affronting the logic demanded by the balanced intellect. It is that illogical truth that we realize as and when we are unobstructive. Now I have kept on saying so far, unobstructive to the transcendent. But that also means unobstructive to the totality. To be unobstructive to the totality. You will find a great many ordinary problems in everyday life disappear. If one can hold that awareness, remain in that awareness of unobstructiveness to totality. It is an extraordinary solving. It's a universal solvent. You know how, I think it's the alchemists, isn't it, who state that water is the universal solvent. It happens that even chemically speaking, the solvent powers of water are really quite extraordinary. It seems as if no other liquid that we know has the extensive solvent powers that water has. you see. All right. The alchemists used the term water symbolically. They didn't mean what we commonly call H2O nowadays. Water symbolizes life, as fire symbolized the spirit for them, amongst many other symbolisms. Life. Life has this remarkable solvent power. To be unobstructive to the totality means to be unobstructive to life also. I don't know what life is. It's a mystery. This extraordinary thing, life. Just speaking scientifically, we can say that if a material structure displays such and such qualities, such and such phenomena, we say that that structure is a living structure. You take your amoeba, you take a single cell in your own body, it displays self-motivation, self-reproduction, self-healing. These are the characteristics of a living cell. If that cell is dead, it cannot display self-motivation, self-reproduction, self-healing. It can't do it. And we say that that is the difference between the living and the dead. That is the way a biologist looks at it. But the word life has a much deeper, profounder meaning altogether. And even the scientific world is slowly extending its frontiers to enter into this deeper religious meaning of life. I was hesitating between saying philosophical and religious, but I think religious meaning is perhaps better than saying philosophical meaning of life. The whole universe is a living universe. It's an extraordinary thing. We don't know really where to draw the lines. Right up till the 1950s, for instance, the world of science more or less stood in this position, that if any particular structure displayed learnability, the capacity to learn, then one could say that mind is associated with that structure. That was a convenient way for the scientists to look at mind and what is mind. If anything which existed as a particular thing as such displayed the capacity to learn, it displayed mind. And by that token, every single cell in our body has mind, because a cell has the power to learn. This is scientifically known. But does it end there? We don't know. Maybe there may come a time, I'm not saying that it will, there may come a time when we may discover that the atom displays learnability, in which case mind is involved with the atom. And if mind is involved with the atom, shall we say or shall we not say that life is involved with the atom? That the total process of manifestation is the process of the unfolding of life? We don't know. I don't know, certainly. There's one advantage of being ignorant. The load is lighter. The load which one carries. So now, one is therefore unobstructive to life. And in this unobstructiveness to life, so much of turmoil and trouble around one, and which comes to one because one is involved in any such and such a situation, you may find that that will resolve, not be pushed aside. You won't run away from it, but the discord will be resolved. If one is truly religious minded, then one will see that one's state of awareness of one's existence from moment to moment, which includes the whole milieu, the whole situation in which one is, the state of awareness is the determining factor there. Not what you think merely with the brain, not merely what you feel because your glands are stirred or whatever it is, not merely what you do with your hands or your skill or anything. Those are all the secondary expressions of your state of awareness. This is why this mysterious thing, consciousness, which we simply cannot pinpoint. What on earth is consciousness? We cannot pinpoint it. Is of such potency. Consciousness is a no-thing in the very real sense. Far more so than mind is no-thing. But learn to be unobstructive this way. Means the absence of conflict. And what do you think? What do you see, truly see, as the most powerful factor involved in this state of the absence of conflict within oneself? An external situation will always present situations of conflict. Can't get away from that. If the other fellow disagrees with you, wants to be nasty with you, makes trouble for you, you can't stop that. There is conflict, a situation of conflict. But what is it in me, myself, that can be the great resolving power in relation to that conflict? What is in fact the absolute indispensable basis of all spiritual flowering out, of all religious realization, which means realization of transcendence? What is the absolute indispensable basis of it? No other than simple purity. Purity of thought, feeling, speech, act. The silas of Buddhism. The commandments of the Judeo-Christian tradition. The yamas and the niyamas of the Upanishads and all Hindu teaching. The Zarathustrian summing up of all morality in terms of good thoughts, good words, good deeds. But bear in mind very carefully, the goodness which is not the goodness of a relative ethic, which is the consequence of my personal experience and the spinning out in my little brain of a conception of good, a conception of what is bad, but a transcendental good, the divine good. Zarathustra uses the term vahu mano, and vahu mano is presented in his teachings originally as one of the supreme expressions and powers of Ahura Mazda, the creator, of the Supreme Being. Now obviously that good cannot be put into the petty little mold of what I think and believe is good. What I think and believe as good has to cease to be obstructive to that good. Its opaqueness, the opaqueness of my little good. Because my little, and this opaqueness comes about because my little good has so many other factors, unconsciously at least, if not conscious, unconsciously and consciously, interfering with the good. Take the simplest in a factor which interferes, what we call enlightened self-interest. A most marvelous piece of humbuggery invented by the mind of man, enlightened self-interest. The pure and the good evil, you might as well say. It's as absurd as that. But this good, this love, this wisdom, this purity is of a transcendental nature. The ethic involved is the transcendental ethic. And of course, we are immediately up against the problem, how can I conceive of or be in touch with a transcendental ethic? I can't. But the transcendental ethic will operate as and when I remain totally attentive and fully mindful, wholly mindful of the actual is here and now. I've said this already ad nauseam. I've said it about 250 times in the last few years. You can't put cleanness into the room. I can only remove the dirt. And the room is clean. I can't cultivate purity of virtue. But by being totally aware of the actual is in the moment and in all successive moments, through that awareness, the evil is resolved, transformed. And there is purity, goodness, love, wisdom, call it what you will. It's not something which you can acquire. This is where, I suppose, in fact, practically all the religions of the past have made their mistake in their verbal formulation. They all say, strive to live the good life, the virtuous life. You must be the champion of truth, as Zarathustrianism puts it, against the lie. Champion of the truth against the lie. You see? And so forth. Well, that's all nonsensical. If I'm going to be a champion of truth against untruth, untruth I do know out of my personal experience here, but if I say I'm going to be a champion of truth, then I must know what truth is. But if I really know what truth is, I have no problem of fighting against untruth. I am true already. You see, the transcendent is the unknown. To put it in simple language, to use simple little words, almost English understatement, the good things are the unknown things, the unconscious things, the spontaneous things. Virtue is like that. Now we have to wake up to this. We may have heard it, we may have read it again and again, but you know, it has not made sufficient impress. It has been ineffective. This sounds as if it were somewhat of an insult, a little bit derogatory to the intelligence and the decency and the good character of the listener. Not a bit of it. It isn't. It is a simple fact, is it not? Otherwise, would I go through all the things that I go through throughout the day in reaction to the stimuli that come to me? Note the anger, the hate, the etc., 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 which comes up in me throughout the day. This is what I have to note. This happens. Why does it happen? How does it happen? Because this is not the pure temple of the Lord. That's all. The doing is the being attentive. Really be attentive and be aware, awake. This is what it is. Have you ever seen two children, two boys at school really get enraged against each other? Have you seen how they fight? Their tendency is to shut their eyes and hit out. It's a very curious thing, isn't it? Not always, but very often. I've watched this. Again, not often watched it because I haven't had so many opportunities to watch. But what few opportunities I've had when I've been close enough to see, I've noticed that in many cases, the tendency is to shut the eyes, not to see, hit out blindly, as we call it. Now, this is how the psyche reacts to the stimulus which comes to us from outside or from inside as the result of memory, of fantasy, and so forth. We hit out blindly. Take a case of a fantasy from inside. One reads the news or hears the news. Such and such a thing has been done. And immediately our rage is out at the evil done to so and so. Take, for example, the case of the abduction of this Mrs. Mackay, you see. And one may sort of feel how horrible, how hateful a thing, and the people like that ought to be, now we let fly. Proper rage and anger, don't we? What the terrible things that ought to be done to the evildoers who cause such hurt and sorrow to unoffending people. But why does that fantasy start up? The one to whom evil has been done is the child of me, God. The evil doer who has done it is also the child of me, God. Only my godhood tumbles down into devilry very easily, doesn't it? When I take sides. We say, yes, but this is natural human nature. Human nature. Be careful. This is animal nature, yes. That's the point. Animal doesn't know the transcendent or transcendence. Hasn't awoken to transcendence at all. Hasn't even a glimpse of it. It reacts automatically, driven by the electrochemical processes that take place through its brain and nervous system. But if I am really awake, this is where you or I, the individual person, does his job. This is the doing. The being aware and doing nothing, either with thought or with word or with physical act. With being aware. Now we mustn't carry this to ridiculous lengths. somebody, if one talks like this in a large audience, you might get somebody saying, yes, now, does that mean that supposing you see a little child suddenly step off the pavement and walk in front of the bus, you're just going to be aware and stop there? No, of course not. All that one needs to say in answer to such a question, don't let such a stupid question crop up. Be sensible. But where the inner life is concerned, it is not like the little child that steps off the pavement in front of the bus. It isn't like that. Something quite different. You can't take a mood or a thought and drag it back onto the pavement. So this thing of purity, this question of purity, and this question of mindfulness. You see, all these great scriptures have talked about it. Jesus said, watch and pray. And pray means to be in communion. Watch means to be mindful. The Buddha said, Samma Sati, perfect mindfulness, and Samma Samadhi, perfect communion. And you find this in the great religions in various forms. You'll find it directly stated by Jesus and the Buddha like that. You will find it also directly stated in Hindu teachings and in a less direct form in Zarathustrian teachings. I don't know about Islam. I'm ignorant of the Quran, really. I know frightfully little about it, so I don't say anything about it. But you'll find this in the great religions. This perfect watchfulness. This perfect mindfulness. Now, if we are truly concerned with the religious life, if we are truly concerned with the release of the new world order and its flowering, we must ask ourselves the question, am I mindful throughout the day? And if not, why not? Am I mindful with this intensity? When we want to cook a meal, we don't do just peel the potatoes, say, and then expect a meal to appear. Not at all. You've got to go right through the whole process, haven't you? And pay attention. Pay proper attention. Otherwise you might have a nice charred mess in the saucepan. Full attention. Perfect mindfulness. Is my hunger and thirst for transcendence of that intensity? You see, when the person is awake like that, then whatsoever the transcendent is, it operates through this thing. The obstructiveness, the opacity of this creature begins to disappear. The transcendent can flow through. This inner realm of the heart, which is full of faith, which is wholly concerned with transcendence, is a sanctum which can never be invaded by the devil. The rest of me can be the devil, but not that. It is a sanctum into which God will not enter and compel. There is no need for God. because this is godliness. You see, you will know, you will get aware of the state of transcendence. If there is a realization for a fraction of a second even, suddenly you will be aware. And one of the signs that this is not an illusion, a self-glorification, one of the signs is that you'll be perfectly quiet. There'll be a matter-of-factness about it, a state of simple ease. You won't be excited about it. As it happens, you won't be sort of in a state of ecstasy beside yourself. To be in ecstasy means to be beside yourself. But you'll be perfectly calm. In other words, you will be yourself. Now, when there are people who are like that, they are the sort of centers through which the new life wave will release the shapes that it wants, not predetermined by me. My task is simply to be clean. If this is clean, the Lord will enter and do what the Lord wills, to put it in theistic terms. But somehow or other, the new life way will work, and whatsoever obstructs it gets broken and swept aside. In a small way, historically, look at its manifestation in terms of the Egyptians and the Israelites, in the whole story of what happened. In the first contacts, Joseph rises to a position of great power and all that. Then later on there comes a Pharaoh who oppresses the Israelites. Isn't that so? And the Lord God lays upon Moses the burden of assigns to him the duty of taking the Israelites out of the land of bondage. And Moses does that. He takes them out of the land of bondage. And in taking them out of the land of bondage, because the Egyptians resist the will of the Supreme One, he breaks them, doesn't he? This is how the story is put. It's put in terms of a symbolical story, not for a moment that there were the actual plagues of Egypt and so forth. Although locusts could very easily have been a bit of a plague there. But it's a symbolical story to show that it breaks, that the life wave breaks the obstructions. And then all the chariots of the Egyptians and the Egyptian army are engulfed in the Red Sea and all that. The Israelites cross over dry land and so forth. See, these are the ways in which in past centuries, they taught wisdom. Now we have to learn from that. The new year and the new decade then. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that we make solemn new decade resolutions. Because we shall be making shapes, preconceiving. Just be open. Inwardly quiet, poised. Clean. Nothing to obstruct. That transcendent love and wisdom and truth and beauty, and goodness, and above all, the simple, pure life, which will work its sweet will through us as centers. That is the only way. Then there is no selfness involved in it. And insofar as that can manifest through such and such individuals, will be the fulfillment of the religious life for each one of us.